I'll hand on to our final speaker now, Simona Fabrizi. Go ahead, Simona.
Morning, everyone. I'm going to talk about innovation and in a slightly different way than the way we looked at so far. And in particular, I will start my presentation focusing on venture capital industry and the role that that plays in somehow together with, in conjunction with intellectual property rights, in shaping incentives to innovate. First thing I would like to mention is that all that I will talk about is mainly based on research work I've been doing together with a collaborator, Stefan Lippert, within the process of project that has been granted the master grant. So the bottom line of this is really venture capital innovation and its theoretical work. So it's a slightly different perspective than the one of the previous speakers. So first one that I'm willing to discuss here as the first one in particular on venture capital and innovation is based on recent contribution where we basically stress the importance of looking at the so-called usefulness requirement as it's referred to in the U.S. patent law, otherwise referred to as likely industrial applicability in the European patent law or in the wording of the New Zealand equivalent would be the concept of utility or so-called industrially applicability of a given innovation, which can be then used or made in some kind of industry. What we argue here, what we've shown with our theoretical modeling, is that patentability of the innovations, which are based upon, in particular, usefulness requirement, are crucial to the well-functioning of a venture capital industry. And why are we looking at venture capital industry? Why is that important for New Zealand in particular? Is that, as it has been stressed by the other contributors, in New Zealand, there are lots of small and medium enterprises, and many of them are faced with the constraints, financial constraints, of getting their business run and get to the final stage of development of ideas. So we don't necessarily lack ideas, but we might lack the means to bring them up to the market. So venture capital steps in this kind of scenario and can provide an alternative way to raise funds and get those ideas and bring them up to the market. So it seems to be very relevant, in particular for New Zealand, because it can play a crucial role. So what we have been obtaining is that when we introduce such clauses, these clauses make it more difficult to patent innovations which would be having low value as compared to those with high commercial potential. So we have to think about the usefulness clause as some sort of potential to be brought up to the market, so their commercial potential really. What does it mean? It means that this would lead venture capital to fund more likely good projects than discard the ideas, say, that are not as valuable for the market, thus providing them with incentives not to have to invest as much as they should have otherwise. So it solves for say, a market failure, if you like, of an overdevelopment by venture capitalists, as is often being observed in other economies, such as in Silicon Valley and California district. And the idea would be that venture capitalists do not need to invest as much in order to signal the goodness of those projects to the market. So by inserting this usefulness requirement, this clause, this would actually reduce for a potential externality in having to over-invest into good ideas to signal them to the market prior to an exit through, say, IPO, international public offerings, or through mergers and acquisitions. What that does, of course, it reduces the patenting intensity of venture capital companies, the ones that are funded through venture capital. It decreases the venture capital-backed companies' long-run performance advantage over the ones that are not funded by venture capital companies, but also has advantage to mitigate what has been observed as being a more negative reaction in the stock market to announcement of acquisitions of venture capital-backed firms. So in other words, this would actually decrease the costly action of having to acquire exposed, develop innovation after they've been developed through a venture capital industry. And ultimately, we have shown through our modeling results that this has a beneficial impact on incentives to come up with ideas and good ideas in the first place. So it does increase entrepreneurial incentives to innovate, which seems to be suggesting the idea that with the implementation of such clauses, we can actually boost the innovativeness without necessarily having to go through increased exacerbated patenting rate rates to do so. So there is some sort of selection toward good ideas to be actually brought up to the market. So kind of connected to this work is another one that I've been conducting together with another colleague here at Mass University and colleague at Melbourne, University of Melbourne. And what we were dealing with is the idea of often venture capital industry is organized in such a way that venture capitalists do not just select, say, good ideas and they bring them up to the market, but often they might, at some stage, early or late, decide to syndicate research projects among them. In other words, they would actually pick up ideas from each other and eventually terminate some of the previous projects they were involved in and pursue together in conjunction syndicating investment from a certain moment onward instead. So we wanted to find out a way to model this behavior and actually under which circumstances this would be indeed the case. And we have been proving that elimination of viable and rival research projects or ideas is more likely when information about those ideas becomes publicly available or it is publicly available. In other words, the more information venture capitalists can share among them, the more likely it is that good ideas are actually terminated when they should have not been, decreasing the social value of ideas that are never making up to the market stage. So this is kind of worrying and a little bit counterintuitive maybe, but the idea being that maybe then early patents or too easy patentable idea too early at the early stage of development by fully disclosing the characteristics of those ideas do the contrary of what we would think they would do. So transparency in this case is not a good thing because they make their value become public, but this introduces incentive to actually dismiss them, thus leading to wasteful elimination of good ideas for further development. So the question then we're asking ourselves, and it's still an open question, so the first part we have been able to show, but the second part is still then raises the question whether or not patents at later development stages would do a better job instead. So when is the right time to patent an innovation then? That's the right question that we should be asking ourselves next. And this is very much an open question we're still trying to address by analyzing the incentives for venture capital to indeed team up and syndicate their development at different possible stages. And in order to answer that question, we have started analyzing in a different work with Francis Bloch, a professor from Ecole Polytechnique in France, an expert in coalition formation and incentives, mechanism design. We have tried to analyze incentives for partners to enter partnership, research partnership, early rather than late. So what are indeed the incentives for different, the timing of teaming up matters. It has consequences. Who knows what when matters as well. And does information about the quality in particular of early research projects, which might not be common to everybody or all the potential research partners, might be crucial in order to determine whether or not a partnership is viable, whether it is desirable from a profitability perspective from the business, of course, but whether also is good for society. In other words, do we have to incentivate more or less likely early rather than late projects as a function of which information is available to whom and what should be the mechanism of sharing, transferring beneficial results of successful innovations across the partners should also matter. So the mechanism design literature steps into our work in trying to give us some insights as to what are the conditions that would determine stable formations of partnerships early rather than late or vice versa. So under which conditions those can be come to existence and under which conditions those are actually maximizing, say, social welfare of the innovation brought to the market. Related question, so it's broad research on research and development is really about incentives to innovate more in general, so not necessarily only in the context of venture capital, of early versus late research, but also about the intrinsic nature of research, which, as we know, is not deterministic. Often we might be involved in research, but that doesn't mean necessarily that we are going to be successful when we do it. So the question is, what determines a success? And now if we embrace the idea that success might have a lot to do with the ideas and the way they are conducted, the way the projects are developed, and who does what, when, and who knows what when they do it, then we can distinguish maybe scenarios in which research activities can be, say, perfectly directed, or in other words, there is a complete freedom, say, of the researchers in conducting them, and other scenarios in which instead those research can be directed almost perfectly. And we think about maybe the parallel between fundamental research, presumably more difficult to be perfectly directed, as compared to pure development of something that has been already somewhat invented and just needs some extra improvement at the margin with some procedure, maybe extra characteristics that need to be adapted for the market purposes. So the question here is, and I was actually happy to hear the comment before about more collaborative research, that those are to be encouraged and so on, but we actually show that this is not necessarily the case when indeed there is some problem as with regard to observability of efforts that are put into research. In other words, we have shown through our research so far that depending on whether or not efforts can be directed or, say, are observable or whether they're not, in other words, they cannot be perfectly directed, there's some sort of moralizer behavior, say, from the part of the research team of the researchers, it's not necessarily true that joint research is always desirable from a social standpoint, but actually other forms of research being conducted differently, like standalone and separately, might actually lead to higher results. Now, what does it mean, higher results? Well, we could argue that there are different ways of measuring innovation, and our way to stand on it is to say, well, we can measure innovation like the probability of coming up with an innovation. In expected terms, how likely it is that we are going to be successful in developing that given something that we're interested in pursuing for the market. Now, if we take that as a measure, indeed, under some circumstances, we show that joint research is not necessarily more desirable than conducted separately. So we really show under which condition this current joint research would lead to higher social welfare and higher innovativeness in the economy when measured in terms of more likely probability, higher probability of succeeding in the marketplace. And this is really a function of observability. So when efforts are not as observable, there is a tendency to suggest, based on our results, that actually you would rather want to discourage joint research instead of having it conducted jointly. Which brings us to the next question, which is almost at the end of what I wanted to present. Still not done, but somehow this brought us thinking about maybe we have a little bit of a parallel between fundamental research and development, as I was suggesting before, perfectly directable and not perfectly directed. And if this resembles a little bit what happens within academia, if you like, freedom and more difficult to be directed and private sector where development seems to be more relevant often, which it is a very clear goal of commerciability for the industry, maybe we have really two extreme situations so far in our research. But we might think about some hybrid situations of public-private partnerships instead, borrowing a little bit from the very new and growing literature on public-private partnerships and try to see how that would actually provide a framework, sort of an hybrid structure for incentives within the public, say academia research, and the private partnership, when these two indeed go together and which type of contract should be designed between these parts that would be part of the partnership in order to overcome some of the drawbacks of the say, unpleasant, if you like, results that we get, which seems to suggest that not every time you join forces is good, but it might still be okay if you do it right. So that's the idea would be to say maybe there is a way to design contracts which would create incentives to innovate and take the best of each of the two worlds, if you like. So that would be a little bit still to be done. And at the very end, there is some little interest that we are having in research, but still really in the works, about the fact that ideas are scarce and money is even scarce, as I said before. So that's why entrepreneurs often have to fight to get their ideas through and funded for further development. But the question is, to which extent should we protect those ideas might also be counterintuitive to have to suggest that maybe too much protection of those might actually be counterproductive, in the sense that in the presence of potential for stealing of ideas, it might be possible to argue that maybe entrepreneurs are more likely to team up with venture capitalists rather than the industry, precisely when intellectual property rights are not well protected, which in the end of the day might boost innovativeness altogether, exposed as a result of that. But as I said, this is still in the works, so I don't have clear results on this part yet, but I think it's an important question that needs to be addressed somehow to understand more of the role of overprotection and the emphasis on intellectual property, how much of that should be put on, indeed, when we are thinking about the role of innovativeness and ideas in the market. So, yeah, that's what I wanted to say. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Simona. I'm going to unmute the participants. Bear with me for a moment. I see that Patrick Smelly from Business Wire has raised a couple of questions in the chat box. If you'd like to go ahead, Patrick. Mm-hmm. Well, I still see him logged in, but perhaps not attentive at the moment. So if I could open it to other questions there from the floor.
Hello. This is Owen Hembury from The Herald. Professor Oxley say a little bit more. He was saying towards the end, I think he was talking about bias towards blue sky research and the new proposed ministry as a more of a sort of a CRI focus, excluding universities. Can he sort of say a little bit more about sort of evidence for that sort of position that he sees and maybe what he thinks needs to happen?
Okay, Les Oxley here. This is still a more of a discussion document coming out of this proposed new ministry, but there's some interesting developments coming out of statements from the foundation, which are saying things that they're no longer going to be funding the BIS and SET portfolio projects because they regard them as providing lower economic impact than some of the other portfolios. The difficulty here is that there's no real way. Easy way of evaluating that return on investment from those more business-related aspects of the patient research here. And it's just reading the document, the other document that's come out is Igniting Potential. And much of the language is written in a sort of a more old-fashioned Frascati-type view of what innovations are, and much less about innovations involving bringing products to market. And it's this distinction between creating new products and getting products to market, which I think is not well represented in the rhetoric coming through. And that, when I'm saying it sort of favors CRIs over universities, it's partly in relation to the success of CRIs creating new products, but not necessarily turning those new products into things that get to the market. And university departments, business departments have expertise in trying to understand what that problem is in New Zealand, and it's not at all clear in the discussion documents that is going to be research that is going to be funded.
Anthony Scott, I see that you had questions on a similar topic in the chat box. Did that answer your question, or did you need to follow up there?
Yeah, thanks. Liz, I just wanted to follow up on that answer. Were you asking, therefore, funding for university academics to research how to get products and so on into market, or were you saying that they are actually better at doing that anyway?
I think there's, again, reading the documents, which are quite high-level documents, it's not at all clear that there's a willingness to provide research to understand how to get these new products to market in New Zealand. And I sort of reiterate some of the points that Sean made about the size of New Zealand businesses and the size of the New Zealand market is idiosyncratically small and needs to be understood. And I think there needs to be more research on how we get these good ideas to market and keep those products being produced in New Zealand. And it's not at all clear from the discussion document that is coming out that there will be money available for anyone to do that, be it universities or CRIs. But the situation is that sort of expertise is more concentrated in the universities.
I take heart from the $11 million, for example, over 4 years being put into the commercialization centers, and the fact that from where I sit, I see universities and CRIs working collaboratively on these matters. So I'm hoping that we can take up Sean's points that we can be that city of 4 million and dip into everybody's expertise.
Great. All right, I will read out Patrick Silly's question, which he's asked me to do. This is a question I believe directed for Simona. It says, why does early disclosure of new ideas lead to their early rejection?
Yeah, this refers to the work that I mentioned about the fact that sometimes if information about ideas becomes public, this might facilitate their termination, their early termination. And this is likely to happen in particular when the ideas are good, which then creates the wasteful elimination of ideas. So if, suppose, ideas were eliminated and those were the best one anyway to be funded, that wouldn't be much of a problem. It would actually be some sort of efficient mechanism. But what we're trying to suggest is that there are circumstances under which the opposite happens. The good ideas, in particular those, are actually rejected. And the reason for that is because there is a competition effect which is somehow driving that decision within a syndicate, in particular venture capitalists, who happen to each be involved in different projects, in eliminating particularly dangerous competing rival projects, especially when they are so good and where good news come into the picture, signals about their likeliness of being successful, say both or several of them in competition with each other. So it's really competing good ideas that are increasing the chances of rejection, which makes us be worried about the fact that if somehow they are free to do it and if information can flow freely among them and there is no friction to that, well, the paradox arises that we have wasteful elimination of good ideas. That's precisely the mechanism that we are highlighting. And there is no really any control from regulation or merger control when it comes to VC teaming up together to form a syndicate. So there is unregulated framework completely, and there is not unlikely to envisage that scenario to actually happen. And the question is, we should be aware of the danger. Yeah.
Great. Is there another question? If you could please identify yourself, too, before you ask it. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was actually another question from Nina Fowler, I see here.
Shall I go ahead with that one?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Nina.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just wondering how our venture capital funding market, and particularly for innovation, stacks up to other countries, if your research has touched on that.
Yeah.
I would expect us to be pretty new in that area, pretty young compared to some other countries, just in terms of scale.
Yeah.
And if so, what is your top suggestion for improvement?
Yeah.
We're dropping
precisely
that clause in, that utility clause.
Yeah. There isn't much work done on venture capital in New Zealand. There isn't much data available on that because they're very sparse. The industry is not as mature, if you like, as it is in other countries such as the USA and Europe. There is a research report that has been commissioned by the Ministry of Research, Science, Technology back in September 2005 by some leading contributions by Josh Lerner, David Moore, and Stuart Shepherd. And Josh Lerner happens to be an expert in venture capital capital industry. He's at Harvard University. So he's been possibly the research that's contributed the most to the venture capital industry research, but most of the data are actually based on U.S. Markets. And the question is really to try to understand how, for example, in New Zealand, this can be applied, because it cannot just be, applied right away due to the difference in sizes, different in possibility of collaboration, different maturity of the market has been suggested in general in innovation. And I suppose that the closer we get to a suggestion that can be used, say, right away, as it is right now, probably, is this concerned about the fact that the law has to pick up somehow and put more emphasis, contrary to what has been done so far, even in the USA, on the concept of usefulness or utility in New Zealand words, because a lot of literature, lots of attention has been put on novelty requirements, being the first to come up with an idea, or inventiveness or non-obviousness, otherwise referred to in the literature on innovation in the law, in the U.S. law, patent law, but not much emphasis has been given on the clause of industrially applicable, in other words, potential for commercialization. And once we do that, that becomes relevant because it's more demanding of a requirement, of course, which delays, if you like, the possibility of patenting. Only really extremely good idea would make it through sufficiently late, which then would delay also the information, say, that is needed to be kept somehow secret. Non-disclosedness clauses are very, very favorable for actually small enterprises to be able to secure their rights on those research and team up with venture capitalists and so on. So our research seems to suggest that too much protection too early and too easy patenting and send away those patents too early might actually be counterproductive. So that's a little bit our stand on it.
No, thank you. That was
yeah.
Great.
Another question from the floor?
I have another question.
Yep.
Go ahead. Okay, I'd just like to ask perhaps the first two panelists how they feel about the shift from a tax credit scheme to the new voucher system for research and innovation. The government has specifically said they're targeting businesses who've already proved themselves, and I was just wondering if there are any thoughts there about the implications for small and medium enterprises from that shift.
Hey, Les Oxley here to start this one running. I think just to start off the discussion, the previous tax credit system was one that was far too bureaucratic for most businesses to deal with. And it will be interesting to see how the new voucher system works. But I think part of the issue is that it's focusing on those that are already doing R&D. That's one of the criteria for receiving the voucher. And one of the issues, potential issues, is the large number of very small firms that really would not be included in this new scheme because they're far too small and they're not undertaking R&D. So there's nothing in this new initiative that would change the vast proportion of small business R&D potentials because they're not getting any benefit from it.
Yeah, Sean Hendy here. I guess I'd add, I showed a figure that showed how there was quite a strong correlation between patenting and business spending, and I guess, you know, following on from Les, I guess you want to design a system that's as cheap as possible for encouraging business R&D spending, because it does appear that increasing R&D spending does increase your patenting rate. And presumably your innovation rate. So doing it as efficiently as possible is I think the way you want to approach it. I think yes, the R&D tax credit was a bureaucratic way of doing it, but nonetheless, a lot of countries use it. You know, and it doesn't. You know, I guess. You know, at least in terms of the spending that delivers, there doesn't seem to be a particular difference between different countries and their patenting rates based on that spending. But I think we do have to confront the problem that we have the small business size in whatever system we have. We have to understand that, and our system, you know, should be targeted to address the fact that we have very small businesses.
Right, hello, it's Peter Kerr here. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Peter.
Peter Kerr from Business Desk, colleague Patrick Smalley. Is one of the take-home messages here then that we want to generate more small ideas that we don't patent?
Is this a question for all of us?
Well, I'll throw it open. You've all brushed across different parts.
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be a slight difference in perspective between what I suggest and what has been stressed by the other contributors. If I concentrate my attention in particular on venture capital industry, and if I think about the fact that this industry is still in its infancy and is not very mature, and these businesses are not that big in New Zealand as compared to the size in other countries, I would definitely stress the idea that it is even more crucially important here that ideas get, of course, supported, however, not necessarily through too early parenting being granted too early at too early stages of development. So that's my stand on it. I'm not saying that parents are not good. I'm just saying that they should come not too early in order to not kill incentives for good ideas to be actually developed further and to be actually funded, rightfully so, through a channel like venture capital, which could be complementing the normal sources of funding, especially for small firms that don't have, they're more credit constraints, constrained than other big firms. And that's particularly the case in New Zealand, I would say. So it's not about patents are not good, they're not necessarily too good when they come too early. So they should actually be more demanding and be granted at a later stage of development to in order to boost innovation. Might seem a paradox, but that's really what seems to come out from our research, indeed.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Can I add something in there, Dacia, on answer to that question? I think that we also have to remember that not all these innovations are patentable, and that we should be aware of the fact that we can be quite innovative without actually taking out a patent or trademarking these issues. And that's one of the big movements that have been useful at the OECD to recognise that innovation is more than just these patentable ideas.
All right, well, we'll have to wrap it up there. Thank you very much to all three of our panelists and to the journalists who've dialed in. We will make an audio recording available as soon as possible today on the public part of our website. And if you'd like to refer back to the slides from the presenters, those are now going up into the resource library. They'll be there shortly. So thank you very much once again, and this will conclude our briefing.